The title of this talk is Discerning a Vocation to Be a Catholic Intellectual. So I made up the title, but I'm not sure it's a good title. We'll see as we go forward. So Discerning a Vocation to Be a Catholic Intellectual. To talk about this requires us to talk about God's plan for your life. Usually that's what people mean when they talk about discernment. You know, how do I figure out God's plan for my life? And some people think that God has a plan for my life, something along the lines like this, that God has inscribed something on a stone tablet in heaven, which is his plan for what he wants me to do. And now my job is to try and guess what it is. And if I get it wrong, I'm going to screw everything up. And so then I work myself into all kinds of knots, worrying that maybe I'm getting it wrong, and how will I ever know if I've gotten it right? And it just seems impossible, and I want to do the perfect thing, but I don't know what that is. And so I end up stuck. Other people will say, well, actually, what I need to do to figure out what's written on that stone tablet is to interpret all of the supernatural signs that are happening around me. So maybe it's like, oh, I think I saw in the way the cream dropped into my coffee this morning that God wants me to be a contemplative nun, you know, because I just saw the way the cream billowed, you know, or something like that. Okay, perhaps you're familiar with some of these kinds of ways of going about what might be called vocational discernment. I think this is all based on a kind of misunderstanding or even an error. I think in general, if you want to think about this sort of question as a Thomist or as inspired by the thought of Thomas Aquinas, it's wrong to start off with the idea that there is some kind of immutable plan that I now have to merely figure out and obey. Because while it's true that religious vocations or any kind of vocation involve a kind of listening to God and following his voice, so in that sense you might speak about it as involving a kind of obedience, yet it's not some kind of obscure plan which I myself may not at all want to do, but which I feel like I have to do because God is asking it of me. So yes, obedience is important in responding to God, but a Dominican Thomist wouldn't first of all say that a vocation is a matter of command and obedience. Rather, the typical way that Aquinas talks about this kind of issue is by speaking about desire, by speaking about love, in fact. So in the second part of the Summa, when Aquinas is talking about how we return to God, he begins with happiness and acknowledging that we all desire that happiness. Of course, we don't know exactly what it consists in. And famously, Aquinas goes through these different candidates for happiness. Does it consist in pleasure or wealth or power or prestige or honor or fame and so forth? And he says none of these things are sufficient, and in the end, only God is sufficient. And then you might ask, well, how concretely am I supposed to pursue this happiness? Me, myself, how am I fitted to pursue this life of happiness? Yes, virtue. Everyone needs to acquire the virtues. We talked about that in my first talk. But specifically for me, precisely what form of life am I supposed to be following? A Thomist, I think, would say the answer to that question is going to lie in part in your desires. And this will be how God, in a way, reveals to you what he has made you for. So yes, God does have a plan for your life, and you are supposed to obey that plan, but it won't be a kind of obedience that destroys your desires, but rather one that arouses and awakens the deepest and most sincere desires that you have and brings them to fulfillment, and therefore brings you to happiness, brings you to beatitude. So a vocation, any vocation, should be a path to flourishing, to joy, to peace. And I can certainly tell you that in my own life, I feel profoundly grateful to God that the vocation that he has drawn me into is one where I find a tremendous amount of satisfaction and joy and happiness. I have absolutely no regrets. And so sometimes people will say, oh, you know, gosh, vocation to be a priest or a religious, you know, it involves so much self-renunciation. And yes, there are things that you have to set aside in order to pursue any vocation. If you are going to be married, it means you're not going to be going out on dates with new people every weekend. You know, that's something you have to set aside. And actually, I don't know if you've been out on a lot of first dates, but in general, going out on first date after first date after first date, I mean, it's great maybe the first few times you do it, but after a while, it gets a little old. I was just talking to somebody who was lamenting this fact, like he's getting quite tired of always going out on first dates. You know, you actually want that relationship to go somewhere. And that means you're not going to be going out on first dates with all these other people that you possibly could be going out with. So to pursue one path does mean that some doors will close, and that can be frightening for us. But of course, it's also the way of freedom. Like to be free to be a mother or a father means renouncing going out to the bars every Friday or Saturday night. But that's not a bad thing, actually. It's a wonderful thing as your life opens up in that direction. And also the vocation to be a Catholic intellectual, or if God is calling you to the vocation of the priesthood or the religious life, there are things that you have to set aside, but you set them aside for the sake of something that you love much more. Okay, so following your desires, let's speak for a few moments about that. And this requires some clarification, because a lot of people will misunderstand what a Thomist means when we say, follow your desires, that will be the path of your vocation. Of course, you can't follow just any desire. And we have desires on different levels. We have some desires that are worthy of a vocation before God, and others that are not. So what we're really talking about is a mature desire, a desire that's been purified first of all from sin, but then also purified from what is below, or purified, you know, things that might be legitimate goods, but not the highest goods, goods that are secondary goods or tertiary goods, goods that we can have as long as they're compatible with the principal work of our life. We may still have desires for chocolate or for French wine or something like that. We didn't have French wine at the top of the mountain the other night, but it was made sort of in the style of a French wine, so maybe that counts. I mean, that's good to watch the sunset over the mountains with a glass of wine and friends around. That's a very great good, but it may be incompatible with some vocations, in fact. I mean, happily, being a Dominican priest and working at the Thomistic Institute is not incompatible with that vocation, not at least, you know, not when you're at the Student Leadership Conference. So we're talking about desires that have been purified, we might say mature spiritual desires, instilled and amplified by the grace of God, under the grace of Christ. So above all, a vocation should involve a desire aroused by a supernatural impulse of sanctifying grace. So Aquinas has actually a lot to say about this. And I've given you the first two texts on the handout deal with this in some measure. The first text is from Aquinas's first systematic work, his Commentary on the Sentences. And he talks about the motion that God has implanted in different creatures. Now, one of the things that doesn't appear in this text is the idea that the motion that God gives to a creature is a part of its nature and is manifested by its desire or its inclination. But that's the backdrop for this. So desire doesn't appear in this text, but that is what Aquinas is talking about. So he would say that even inanimate things have a certain desire. When we're talking about things on the surface of this earth, stones have a desire to go down. And we can understand what that means, even though we know that stones don't actually have any kind of conscious desire. They don't have any appetites, really. But they do tend to go down. In fact, they always tend to go down unless something is pushing them in another direction. And if we were to transpose this into the realm of astrophysics, where we're not talking about stones in the gravitational field of the Earth, but we could say that space dust has a desire, a kind of inclination to clump together, which happens over time. And that's how astronomers explain in part planet formation and things like that, that there is a kind of over many millennia, the formation of planets by the space dust gathering together and coming, becoming more dense and so forth. So Aquinas thinks that pertains to every kind of creature, that every nature will have a certain motion instilled in it by God, given the kind of thing that it is, and that this, above all, is the case with the rational creature who has a mind and therefore is also able to understand what the good is and to order his or her life towards that good by your acts. So a stone does not choose to go down. And even an animal like a horse, which is prodded by pleasure and pain to do what it's doing, doesn't deliberate about what is good for the horse's life. But we do deliberate, we do choose, we do move and plan our lives based on what our minds understand. And that's a very important part of living out your vocation, or you could say in the terminology that's often used today, discerning your vocation. So let's look at that first text. He talks about the circular motion of exitus and reditus, coming forth from God and returning to him. It's perfect in certain creatures, while in others it remains imperfect. So I'm going to skip a couple lines here. They're a little bit technical. He's basically explaining that creatures that don't have a rational nature, that aren't able of understanding, cannot perfectly return to God. So if you skip one sentence, he says, rather, only that creature, which in some way is able to attain to the first principle itself, perfectly has this circular motion of coming forth from God and returning back to him. And this belongs only to the rational creature, which is able to reach God himself through knowledge and love. That's the goal, to know God and to love him. And then from the Summa Theologiae, question 93, article 4, this is the second text. This is about the way we are made in the image of the Trinity, or the image of God. And Aquinas talks about three levels of that image in us. The first is simply that we're capable of knowing and loving God because we have minds. But you can perfect that image if you, secondly, actually or habitually know and love God. In other words, you have that capacity and then you begin to use it. You begin to use it in a habitual way, when you have the supernatural habitus, that is another word for the supernatural virtue of faith, of hope, and of love. These things dispose your mind to make acts of knowledge and love of God. And so if you have that virtue, which is instilled into you at your baptism, if you're in a state of sanctifying grace, you have those theological virtues habitually, you're capable now, you're apt by supernatural grace to make that kind of act. But it's even better to not only be capable of making the act, but to actually be doing it. So when you wake up in the morning and you're making your bed, you may not be thinking about God. But it's better, you are more returning to God when you are actually knowing and loving him. The third level of the image of God in us, which you find in the fourth line of that second text, the third way is insofar as man actually knows and loves God perfectly, and this image is grasped according to the likeness of glory. By that, Aquinas means the glory of heaven. When you get to heaven, what you will be doing perfectly is knowing and loving God. These kinds of activities require a kind of maturation of the person. So there's a progression that we go through to grow in faith, to grow in charity, to grow in the capacity to know and love and to actually do it more. So if you want to discern a vocation, any vocation, I think, in the light of grace, the first step, the kind of foundational beginning point, is to begin to mature in your spiritual life. So this kind of advice applies to anyone who is trying to discern any kind of vocation. So you might say, well, okay, how do I do that? Or how does that work? The typical experience that people who enter religious life, and you know, I'm teaching at the Dominican House of Studies, teaching a lot of younger Dominicans, also teaching in the summers, for example, Dominican sisters who come and study with us. And from time to time, we go and visit convents and monasteries of nuns or monks and give lectures and talks. That's the kind of typical work of a Dominican priest who's a theology professor. And you often will hear people in their first years of religious life say something like this. Well, you know, when I was thinking about a vocation, I had some marvelous experiences of God's love for me, of an encounter with God. God seemed very present to me. There were very strong signs that God was inviting me to something supernatural. God seemed so close to me. He's acting, you know, like a plane writing letters in the sky, you know, or flying one of those banners that you see over the beaches on the East Coast, you know, with advertisements. You know, you just can't miss it. Huge letters. But after I entered religious life, then it seemed like God was no longer speaking to me in that way. And now it seems like all I've got is the daily repetition of this form of religious life. And sometimes it's rather difficult. You know, I wake up in the morning, I go to the chapel, there's the divine office, there's mass, there's a person sitting next to me who sings out of tune. Then there's somebody who left the lid off the peanut butter, or there's a mess on the kitchen floor, and it falls to me to clean it up, and all the kind of quotidian things like that. And it seems like now God is far away. Where are the consolations of those early days? Maybe this is a sign that I'm not really supposed to be here, because God is no longer present to me in the vivid way that he was before. But a good spiritual director, I think, will recognize that that's not a very good chain of reasoning. God often uses these kinds of dramatic consolations, significant signs, you might say, to get you moving, because you're not as spiritually mature as you need to be. In other words, those kinds of extraordinary things are often, especially for those more towards the beginning than the end of their process of spiritual growth, those kinds of spiritual signs are often to get you paying attention to him, to get you on the right path. But they're not the goal of the spiritual life. St. Ignatius of Loyola has a very nice saying about this. You should seek the God of all consolation rather than the consolations of God. Because if you seek just the consolations, you won't actually be seeking God. In the end, in a certain way, you're aiming at something in yourself rather than God himself. The real goal of the spiritual life, and Aquinas says this over and over and over, I mean, it's such a deep truth that it becomes a kind of structuring principle for the whole treatment of the Christian life in the Summa Theologiae and elsewhere. The essence of the spiritual life is faith, hope, and love. So the goal is to grow in those virtues. So if you want to discern a vocation, any vocation, including a vocation to a Catholic intellectual life, if you want to do it in the light of God, you start by paying attention to growing in faith, hope, and love. And if you're growing in faith, hope, and love, then your desires will begin to be configured to God, and things will, maybe not right away, but over time and progressively, start falling into place for you, at least in terms of what you perceive to be your mature desires, your purified desires. Well, how do you grow in faith and charity? Here, there is a danger, and it's related to the point that I was just making about the young religious who's looking for spiritual signs like banners flying behind a plane over the beach. There's a great danger of judging your spiritual state or your spiritual maturity or how you're advancing in the spiritual life by looking at your emotional life. So people very often do this. They're asking, well, when I go to pray, does it make me feel like I'm in God's presence? Does it make me feel a sense of peace? What happens if I go to pray and I don't really feel anything? Or if I'm bored or distracted? Or maybe something has just happened to me before I go into the chapel and I'm angry and I can't really think about anything but how angry I am at this person who's just insulted me or whatever it is. Aquinas suggests that you cannot judge whether you are in a state of grace with any kind of certitude, especially not by looking at your emotional life. Because, and this is a point I mentioned in the last talk, grace enters us, you might say, or works on us in the highest part of the mind. So it works on us in the intellect and in the will above all, not in the emotions or the passions, which always have a bodily dimension. And we know, you know, if you think about the feelings that you have, even in English we call them feelings, because there is a distinct bodily feeling about being angry or being sad. They're different from each other. They feel different. Or being happy or joyful or at peace. These involve feelings which have, at least in part, a dimension rooted in our bodies. And our bodies, of course, are changeable. Some days you don't sleep well, or you haven't had enough to eat, and you might be more prone to anger or sadness or whatever. And this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with whether you're in a state of grace, or whether you're in right relationship with God, or whether you're on the right path or not. So the theological virtues and the life of grace, they do over time filter down into the emotional life, and they can transform it, but that's not their first effect. And so you can't judge that spiritual life by your emotional life. Over time, it will have an effect, but it's only a kind of secondary effect over time. What are the normal means for growing in the theological virtues? That is, really making progress in preparing to discern a vocation. Well, here the recommendations are kind of classic recommendations about the spiritual life. You can engage in the acts of the theological virtues. So you have the virtue of love or charity. Make acts of love for God. The more you make those acts, the more you will merit a further increase of them. So God actually wants us to share in his work of giving us these gifts. He's, in a way, given us, it's like he's made a promise. Like I was talking with some of you all at lunch the other day about how merit works. It's a little bit like, you know, a father saying to his child, mow the lawn and I'll buy you a Lamborghini. Okay, mowing the lawn is really, in a certain way, a contribution that the child makes towards getting the reward at the end, but it's vastly disproportionate from what the kid actually gets. Mowing the lawn does something, yes, but it's almost nothing in comparison with the value of the Lamborghini. God works with us a bit like this. He offers us the opportunity to earn, in a certain sense, merit. We would say there's some technical scholastic distinctions needed here. We merit not condignly, not in strict justice, but because God has offered us this promise, he wants us to participate in his generosity of giving us gifts. So he will offer to give us more gifts if we cooperate with the gifts he's already given us. So given that he has already given you the gifts of faith, hope, and charity, as you use them, he will give you more. And he does that not because we deserve it, strictly speaking, but because out of his goodness, he wants us to participate in this work of growing in supernatural virtue. If you look at the third text on your handout, Aquinas talks about how charity increases, and charity is above all the measure of the spiritual life. This is from the Summa Theologiae, question 24, article 6. He says, the spiritual increase of charity is somewhat like the increase of a body. I mean, think about the growth of an animal or the growth of a human being, like your bodily growth from infancy to adulthood. He says, now bodily increase in animals and plants is not a continuous movement, so that, namely, if a thing increased so much in so much time, it needs to increase proportionally in each part of that time, as happens in local movement. I mean, what he means is if you're going 50 miles an hour towards Denver, that movement, you know, for each minute you cross a certain amount of distance. So it's kind of proportional. He says that's not what happens in the increase of our bodies. I mean, in fact, children grow at certain times slowly and at other times very rapidly. So he goes on. But for a certain space of time, nature works by disposing for the increase without causing any actual increase, and afterwards brings into effect that which it had disposed. So my nephew right now is 15 years old, and he's looking a little pudgy. But I think in general with 15-year-olds, when you get a little pudgy, you're getting ready for a growth spurt. You know, he's not that tall yet, but I bet that in a year or so, he will have grown significantly. That's the way nature seems to work in the growth of our bodies. There's a kind of preparation for the body's growth and then rapid, you might say rapid expansion. It's not just completely linear in that curve. Aquinas uses this as an analogy to understand how charity grows. In the same way, in like manner, he says, charity does not actually increase through every act of charity, but each act of charity disposes to an increase of charity insofar as one act of charity makes man more ready to act again according to charity. And this readiness increasing, man breaks out into an act of more fervent love and strives to advance in charity, and then his charity increases actually. What he means is that as we live our life of the theological virtues, it may seem for a long time like not much is happening, not much is changing. But in fact, we really are being purified, becoming more centered on God with each act of loving of Him. And this will prepare us for the moments, the important moments, when we make very important acts of charity, acts by which we really do take a big step forward. Other normal means for growing in the theological virtues, praying for their increase. You can pray for God to help you mature spiritually. Recourse to the sacraments efficaciously confer grace. So frequenting the sacraments will help you prepare for discerning a vocation. And engaging the mind with the mysteries of faith. For a Thomist, the will can only love what the mind already knows. You can't love what you don't know. Growing in knowledge of something, thinking about something more, tends to focus your desires on that thing. And you know this from your own experience. If you meditate on something, if you imagine something, your desires for it may be aroused. The more you think about it, the more your heart will be set on it. And so by regularly thinking of God, you can help your heart grow in love of Him, because the more you know Him, the more you will tend to love Him, especially the more you realize how good He is. So thinking also about the blessings God has bestowed on you. These are very good exercises for arousing a greater love of God. You have more gratitude to God the more you meditate on how gracious He has been to you. So the more our minds focus on the highest things, the more our hearts will follow. And that brings us to the next text that I've given you on the handout. Aquinas actually wrote a short work, this was one of the earlier works of Aquinas, on the perfection of the spiritual life. And he's really making a defense for why, especially young men, should enter religious orders like the Dominican Order. There was a big controversy in Paris where diocesan priests were saying that the Franciscans and Dominicans should not be accepting all of these young men into their ranks, kind of casting aspersions on these new orders. And Aquinas came to the defense of his order, and this was one of the works that he wrote in connection with that. But it's a lot of wisdom about the human heart here. He says, it's abundantly clear that the human heart is more intensely attracted to one object in proportion as it is withdrawn from a multiplicity of desires. Therefore, the more a man is delivered from solicitude concerning temporal matters, that means care for things of this world, the more perfectly he will be enabled to love God. So he quotes St. Augustine. The hope of gaining or keeping material wealth is the poison of charity. That as charity increases, cupidity, that is the love of material things, diminishes. And that when charity becomes perfect, cupidity ceases to exist. Hence, all the counsels which call man to perfection tend to withdraw his affections from temporal objects, so that his soul is enabled the more freely to turn to God by contemplating Him, loving Him, and fulfilling His will. Another way to put this, in there was a spiritual work written by a Carthusian called Love and Silence. And it makes a very beautiful point, which I think is precisely what Aquinas is saying here, which is that the point of the spiritual life is not to master some complex set of truths or to figure out arcane and esoteric knowledge. Actually, God is perfectly simple. We are complex. So we are the ones who make life difficult, you might say, make life complicated. And we make life complicated often because of the conflicting desires that we have in our hearts. The real goal of our faith is to know God in his divine simplicity. He is. He is perfectly good. He is the source of every good. So the goal of our spiritual life is not to enter into some kind of mystical knowledge that gives us a set of complex secrets to life and the universe, but rather to be stripped of our complexity, to divest ourselves of our complexity, our being complicated, in order to enter into the perfect simplicity of knowing and loving God. So growth in the spiritual life actually means discovering the true meaning of the things that, in general, we already know. Like that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Okay, many children know that from their catechism class. But do they actually know what that means? Entering into that kind of truth is what it means to enter into that depth of the knowledge and love of God. And it can be summed up when we will do nothing other than cry out, Abba, Father, which includes, of course, that he's the Father of the Son who gives us the Holy Spirit. In a certain way, perhaps that's the best summary of what we're supposed to be doing with our lives. So knowing and loving God is actually rather simple in itself. The question is arriving at the point where we can give ourselves over to that. Okay, so I've been talking a lot about these desires of this knowledge and love of God. What does this have to do with discerning a vocation to the intellectual life? So maybe I should say a word about this term discernment. Today, especially if you read spiritual writers, discernment is often taken to mean an extended period of introspection, of examining different options, of thinking about what you possibly might do with your life, looking for some sign from God about what he has chosen for you and therefore what he's asking of you. So it's often heavily weighted with two moments, figuring out what God is saying to you or asking of you, and you do that by looking at signs around you, or maybe by looking at signs within you, and then in a second moment, making an act of your free choice to choose it for yourself. And the second element, making an act of free choice, is often rather heavily emphasized. And that's sometimes where contemporary people discerning vocations run into trouble, because they will say, well, how do I get myself to make that kind of wholehearted choice? I feel like some division within myself. I'm not sure I'm ready to make that commitment. There can be a lot of fear of making a commitment today, especially when you have so many options, so many good options. How do I figure out which is the best? This way of thinking about discernment, I would suggest, is heavily influenced by a modern understanding of what human choice is all about. And that modern understanding really arose after Aquinas. It's not Aquinas' principal way of talking about the human act of choice or a human act that's moving towards a good. And perhaps you've heard about this in other contexts, people talking about the difference between kind of big shift after Aquinas away from an understanding of freedom as directed towards the good and now freedom as basically a choice between contraries. So there's a great book, The Sources of Christian Ethics, by a Dominican professor from Freiburg, now deceased, Servais Pinkers. And he labels these two models of thinking about the human act, freedom for excellence and freedom of indifference. He describes Aquinas as speaking about a freedom that is oriented towards the good, as opposed to what he labels as a kind of result of the nominalist philosophical turn in William of Ockham above all, where freedom is now understood to be simply the bare choice between options. So I have a menu of things before me, and I just opt for whatever seems to please me today. You know, yesterday I chose chicken, but today I choose fish, you know? And there's not much more to the decision than what my preference is today. Well, if this is your model for the exercise of choice, then you will find yourself having difficulty in discerning a vocation. Aquinas's and the Thomists, I think, approach to choice is not so much focused on this naked option, but rather grasping what God has implanted in my heart as a desire for the good. So the shaping of the desires is very important, or the maturation of your desire is very important for discerning a vocation. Discernment, in this sense, is not just about a choice, but rather a kind of grasping or recognition of this real good for me as it arises from the desire of my heart, above all, the desire to seek God. Now, of course, Aquinas thinks that you should act with prudence in making decisions. But this choice will begin from a desire, and above all, a desire instilled by grace. So if you're thinking about a vocation, whether it's a vocation to the intellectual life or a vocation to religious life or to the priesthood, the first question is there some attraction in this life to me? And if there is some attraction, that's already an indication that perhaps God is inviting you to that life. So if you have a desire for something like that, perhaps you should begin to test it out by beginning to act in the way a person, say, preparing for an intellectual vocation would act. And you begin to discover if you are well suited to this form of life. So all the things that Dr. Kayser was talking about the other day, about structuring your life and reading broadly, writing every day, that kind of thing, these are kind of the bread and butter of the intellectual life lived out, especially in the academic context of our epoch. You know, if you're going to be a Catholic intellectual in that sense of the term, that's going to be what you're going to be doing. Do you delight in study? Do you have a thirst to go deeper in a field, not just to satisfy the obligations of your professors imposed on you to get your degree, but do you actually enjoy thinking about these things? Are you good at them more or less? Can you practically carry them out in a way that will lead to your sanctification? Can you find a way of sustaining your life if you choose this path? And that's actually a very important thing. Like, you know, if you get a doctorate in philosophy and you can't get a job and support your family, you will probably be forced to do something else. There's a guy that I know very well who got a doctorate in Shakespearean literature from the University of Dallas. Really bright guy. And couldn't find a job afterwards and was working in a lumber yard. And his wife said, "This is crazy. You're working in a lumber yard, you're driving a forklift, you know, you have a doctorate in Shakespeare." Well, it was because he hadn't found a job teaching Shakespeare. And so she said, "Well, I've heard of this new firm that's hiring people for a temporary project. Why don't you go work there?" So he went to this new firm, Microsoft, and he began working there, and 20 years later, he was the head of cloud computing and retired at age 50 with a large a large portfolio. So it worked out very well for him. It didn't work out in the sense of teaching Shakespeare. So that happens to people. So these kind of practical considerations are also important in discerning this kind of vocation. So acting with prudence, developing a sense of prudence, also includes taking counsel from other wise people, people whose judgment you trust. So you should do that. But you also shouldn't wait for the ultimate sign from God to make a kind of decision about your vocation. It's very important to pray, to ask for guidance, but then also to act. For Aquinas, the prudent person is one who not only knows what is the right thing to do, but who does it. So make a tentative choice and begin to move down the path. That's, I think, the step that is most difficult for young people in our contemporary context. They can spend a lot of time thinking about their options. They often have a difficult time beginning to move down the path. But there's no way to pursue a vocation unless you begin moving down the path. You are not finally committed to a vocation when you take step number one. You are only taking step number one. But of course, you take step number one based on a desire that you've discerned in your heart. And as you move down the path, you will begin to discover if that is a realistic path for you. So there will be certain testing, a kind of assessment as time goes on. And most vocations actually have this built into them. So in religious life, you go through a novitiate. You will have a novice master who assesses whether you are fit for this life. And sometimes the novice master says you're not fit for it. And, thanks very much for spending some time with us, but your vocation lies elsewhere. And that's okay. That happens. It happens with actually a significant proportion of the people who start out in religious life. The same is true for the priesthood. The same is true for the intellectual life. If you're going to be an academic, you will need to go through the course of degrees that are needed for your field. And there is a whittling process, a whittling away of the candidates in those things, in those degree programs. So writing a dissertation is not easy. It requires a lot of perseverance. You have to really want it. But if you're inclined to an intellectual vocation, the question is, can you begin it? Start. And you write a dissertation by writing one sentence at a time, as Dr. Kayser was pointing out the other day. So this is the way you move towards the goal of your vocation. Let me conclude just with a quotation from our Lord, from the Gospel of Mark chapter 12, verse 30. He speaks about, he's asked, what are the greatest commandments? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. To love your God with all your heart and your soul and your mind. This is the goal of the intellectual life. It's the goal of the Christian life. It's a true way of sanctification. It's a path towards beatitude. So, let us encourage each other, pray for each other and for ourselves, that we will have the grace to move towards this goal under the impulse and influence of the teaching of Christ. So, thank you.